remained empty.
Japan suggests it's responding to increasing threats from North Korea and China. Over the next 5 years, Japan plans to double its military spending from 1% to 2% of GDP. And much of that more than $300 billion is earmarked to be spent in America's military-industrial complex. Japan's new military budget comes just as the U.S. increases its annual military spending to $858 billion. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Iran's nuclear chief announced this week that the capacity of uranium enrichment in the country is now twice as high as the total volume produced since the onset of the nuclear industry in Iran. He made the remarks in an exhibition showcasing Iran's latest achievements in the nuclear sector.
We aim to generate 20% of the country's electricity from nuclear energy and the use of radiation technology.
This is one of the achievements Iran has publicized in recent days, which is viewed as a response to what Tehran describes as the West dilly-dallying on the revival of the 2015 deal. The pact has been in limbo since the U.S. walked out of it in 2018 and reinstated sanctions on Iran.
The Americans claim that the Vienna talks are no longer a priority for them amid the unrest in Iran. First of all, they have a role in engineering the riots. Secondly, they do want to resume the negotiations, but they are trying to use the unrest as a bargaining chip in the talks.
In October this year, Iran deployed more advanced centrifuges at its three enrichment facilities, increasing their total number to 4,000. The Atomic Energy Organization of Iran announced this week that it's now enriching uranium at a historic 60% rate using the new advanced centrifuges.
As hopes for the revival of the 2015 deal dwindle, Iran says it reserves its right to boost its nuclear energy program, which it says is clearly stipulated in the accord. The AEOI says it will not wait for the resumption of the Vienna talks and will continue to expand its nuclear activities for peaceful purposes. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The Saudi coalition has seized another fuel ship bound for Yemen, keeping it from reaching the port of Hodeidah to unload the much-needed fuel. Military officials based in Sana'a confirmed that they have not ruled out the military option against the Saudi coalition in order to prevent what they call acts of piracy in the Red Sea.
I can confidently say that in the near future or in the days ahead, we will all witness an escalation of military operations, and perhaps we are going to see a one-of-a-kind military operation that will target the vessels in the Red Sea that are pirating Yemeni fuel ships which have received the necessary permits from the United Nations. The Yemeni army could also target the oil industry in both Saudi Arabia and the UAE. I can certainly assure you that the status quo is going to change, as military officials' strategic patience is wearing thin.
According to the spokesperson for the Yemeni petroleum company, Isam al-Mutawakkil, all Yemeni fuel ships are forced to sail on a path crossing near the Saudi Arabian coastal area of Jazan, where an American base is believed to be operating.
All Yemeni fuel ships bound for Yemen have been seized and fallen victim to these acts of piracy near the Saudi coastal area of Jizan, where they are searched under American supervision. This is happening despite the fact that they are already being inspected by Djibouti. Therefore, we should hold accountable the Saudi and American coalition along with the United Nations, which is allowing these acts of piracy that are causing great harm to the Yemeni people.
Yemeni military and political personnel have expressed that a peaceful solution will be impossible if the humanitarian situation continues to deteriorate due to a limited supply of fuel and diesel. Tensions are also on the rise in the strategic province of Hodeidah, where coalition forces are reportedly building up.
If there is not going to be a peaceful or political solution, then perhaps the solution is going to come through the barrel of our rifles in order to stop these aggressor nations which are taking orders from their American and Zionist masters.
As 2022 draws to an end, so do all efforts for a peaceful solution. However, as the humanitarian situation continues to grow worse by the day in Yemen, the military option could be the only option left on the table.
The Yemeni government, based in the capital Sana'a, has proved that it has the military capability to hit long-range targets in land and at sea. However, it is still keen to reach a political solution and end the conflict that has taken the lives of tens of thousands of innocent people. Yusuf Mawdi, Sana'a.
About 70 officials and representatives of think tanks and research centers from 36 countries are in Tehran to attend the Tehran Dialogue Forum 2022. The initiative, dubbed Neighborhood Policy of the Islamic Republic of Iran, is the third of its kind, and this time it focuses on regional friendship and trust building.
The main message of this forum is boosting regional cooperation and dialogue. We always welcome dialogue, particularly when it comes to finding solutions to the challenges that we face.
The keynote speakers of the forum, former Iranian Foreign Minister Kamal Kharrazi, the former Prime Minister of Iraq Adel Abdel Mahdi, the Nicaraguan Foreign Minister Denis Ronaldo Moncada, and other participants reiterated the same stance, giving Iran credit for the initiative.
This is important in order to strengthen your policy in the regional dimension. Due to the new dimension in the whole world and new world order that is much more focused on regionalism than as on the wide international arena.
Pakistan and Iran are the only two countries that are always directly affected by Afghanistan. So I think the Tehran Dialogue Forum is very important in that regard, that there has to be regional dialogue. And Iran being at the forefront of this is a welcoming development. And I think, look, it's important for the region to take ownership. And we see Iran doing that through this forum. And I think it's important, again, to discuss through dialogue to move forward towards any cooperation.
The message of the forum, however, is not limited to regional countries.
We can only really build peace if we do it through dialogue and with the diversity of participation. So I think we are grateful for the invitation to Venezuela, and we think it's important to address this. Even though we're not from the region of Iran, we also think in regional terms. Venezuela is part of Latin America and the Caribbean. We are a zone of peace, as we decreed it in 2014. And we think that it is important for the different regions of the world to establish communication and see how we can really face common challenges.
The first and second rounds of the Tehran Dialogue Forum were held in 2019 and 2020. And as always, addressing the latest developments in West Asia will be on top of the agenda.
The discussions of the Tehran Dialogue Forum 2022 will continue in four different panels, focusing on regional security, energy security, the Ukraine crisis, and the prospects of peace in Afghanistan. Gizumisha Ahmadi, Tehran.
The first Iranian-made particle accelerator. The high-tech device produces high-energy beams by accelerating electrons close to the speed of light. Developed by Iran's Nuclear Science and Technology Research Institute, the Dynamitron-type accelerator was unveiled at the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran on Saturday.
We aim to generate 20% of the country's electricity from nuclear energy and the use of radiation technology. We focused on various accelerators and radiation systems, which can serve a wide range of needs in society. It's a technology that improves the health sector and can be used in food security and environmental preservation.
The Iranian accelerator will be used for food irradiation, cable and wire manufacturing, tire industries, sewage treatment, and sterilization of medical devices. The AEOI says the machine will also be employed in treating cancer patients.
The applications of this technology are numerous, but compared to developed countries, we have stepped into the field of particle accelerators about 50 years later. In fact, we have possessed this technology for a long time, but it was limited to research purposes.
Particle accelerators were first invented in the 1960s to study high-energy particle collisions, but it didn't take scientists long to notice their byproduct, and that is an extremely bright light that can be used in investigating the structure of crystals and proteins, monitoring air pollution, studying disease mechanisms, HD imaging, and cancer radiation therapy, among other applications.
With a wide range of applications, from medicine to agriculture, the homegrown accelerator, as put by its developers, will transform different industries in Iran. Experts here say for sanctions hit Iran, building such a high-tech device is more than an achievement, but a miracle. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Afghan people have been calling for transparent and impartial investigations into crimes and wrongdoings by NATO forces on their soil. Among them, relatives of victims of the NATO war in southern Helmand province are demanding justice for the killing of 54 unarmed people by British Special Air Service troops there. The dead include children. Afghans want the murderers should be held accountable.
Helmand province witnessed deadly night raids and airstrikes by NATO forces, especially those of the UK. Besides, civilian captives were tortured and shot dead. In one case, children were thrown off military planes. I remember so many atrocities by the foreign forces in which civilians were harmed. We call for those British and American perpetrators to be tried in an impartial and transparent court. They should be brought to account and victims should receive compensation.
However, the UK government has announced the start of an inquiry into wrongdoings by its forces in Afghanistan, but some experts say only transparent probes by independent bodies can help make headway with the case. They believe investigations by foreign governments could cover up the facts about the gross violations at the hands of their forces in Afghanistan. During the two-decade US invasion, Afghanistan witnessed much disgrace by NATO troops. More and more facts are emerging regarding unlawful killings and gross violations by foreign forces on Afghan soil. The U.S. war on Afghanistan has left many Afghans in great suffering. People here are calling for accountability and justice for years of gross violation by the NATO troops. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. On Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary. O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to thee, addressing myself to thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to you for the hope of your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of thy creation, the summoner to thy truth. Exalt me with thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
Us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The UK has been accused of a cover-up during the time that they were involved in the Afghanistan war. A new inquiry launched into how the SAS soldiers killed Afghan civilians dated back to the year 2010. Now, what is worse is that this involves more than 50 summary killings by the SAS soldiers. And even worse yet, it came when for years there were reports that elite British troops killed civilians in cold blood, which meant that they were aware of it, authorities higher up. Why was this covered up is the first question, and more importantly, why would the British soldiers do that? Were there orders from the top down? Just a few of the questions we'll be asking our guests in this edition of The Spotlight. First, let me introduce them. Farah Hughes, journalist, author, and activist, joins us from Belfast. Also joining us is Robert Fantina, author and journalist, who joins us from Kitchener, Ontario. Welcome to you both.
The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Farhiz, I'll first start with you. So we have the nature of the crime, as it's been said, which is much more extensive than this, but this is an inquiry that's being held again on more than 50, what we understand, summary killings by the SAS soldiers, 54, according to what has been revealed. And it happened in Helmand province between the years 2010 and 11, of which the conclusion was that this amounted to war crimes. What is your immediate reaction to this, something, again, that's been reopened to follow through in order to perhaps get some prosecution, if that is at all possible?
Firstly, I don't think there'll be any prosecutions whatsoever. If you consider that this is already a decade after these war crimes and murders, extrajudicial executions have been carried out, and it's only now that the second investigation is underway. The people in Afghanistan will never receive justice The only justice they had was at the bayonet points of the British soldiers that had gone halfway around the world to oppress and subdue the Afghan people. As you introduced me, I live in Belfast in Ireland, and we all here know about British war crimes. In 1971, on the 9th of August, when the British reintroduced internment without trial, the British paratroopers run amok in Belfast on the 9th of August 1971 and murdered 11 people in what were called the Spring Hill Ballymurphy massacres. The inquests have only taken part last year, 50 years after those people were brutally cut down, people who were unarmed, including
why does it take so long, though? Why does that take that long for this to be even covered and then, you know, perhaps, again, with, as you said, no prosecution to take place?
Well, it's part of the cover-up. You see, if you don't have an inquest, then there's no accountability as to how the people died. The British government and indeed the British Army claimed that these people were armed, that these were terrorists, that these were insurrectionists, people who died in gun battles, which is all lies, and it's all propaganda and it's all cover-up. And in fact, 6 months after these murders in Belfast, we had 13 unarmed civil rights protesters murdered in Derry on what was called Bloody Sunday on the 30th of January. Right. 1972. And the gentleman who was in charge of that was then later went on to become the general officer commanding of British Land Forces. A soldier one day becomes the general officer commanding several years later after committing war crimes in the streets of Derry.
Okay. Well, I'm going to start out with a general description of a couple of the, first the general, overview, Robert Fantina, of what was disclosed, and then we're going to get into a couple cases, if not three, if we have the time, of the nature of the crimes that were committed, because that needs to be, unfortunately or fortunately, reviewed here, so that you can grasp the gravity of the crime that was committed. First, in terms of the overall view, from the evidence and disclosures required by the court, it says that the Afghan man detained by these SAS soldiers were during night raids, and they were often separated from their families, and they were shot dead. This was routine, where the troops then went and planted weapons on them to justify the crimes. So that's an overall view of what happened. The question is, why would they subscribe, these SAS soldiers, to such a method?
There are a few reasons. One is that they were given orders by their superiors and supervisors to do this, to terrorize the population by killing the men in their, or pulling them out of their homes and killing them. So terrorize the population to subdue them and prevent any kind of resistance to the invading forces could have been ordered by their leaders. The other reason is simply that these soldiers, many soldiers in the United States, the UK, and other places, are trained to kill. That is what they do. That is their job. And so they see anybody and they will kill them. They also, there is discrimination against the people of Afghan. Afghanistan is not a Christian country. It's mainly a Muslim country. And in the West, Muslims are seen as different and dangerous. And so the soldiers who are accused of killing, who allegedly killed these civilians, were probably part of or felt that same way, that these people weren't worthy of life the same way as they were, and therefore they were free to kill them. Now, this is what we see in war frequently, so it's nothing new. The fact that it's been exposed or it's being investigated after all these years simply tells us that the British government doesn't take it all that seriously.
Well, let's take a look at a more graphic example here. And I'm sorry if it bothers you. I do apologize right now. But Fra Hughes, I'm going to go ahead and ask you anyways, because this is one of the things that is pretty much an eye-opener, where you have an instance of two Afghan children where it is, again, citing this source, at 8 p.m. You have the British and Afghan soldiers. They burst into a home, a 12-year-old boy and a 14-year-old, who were staying there overnight, were taken, and a witness said, "When I entered the room afterwards, I saw bones and teeth all over the place. There were four altogether. The four of them were lying there, blood everywhere. Is that what SAS soldiers are trained to do?
I think brutality goes along with the mindset of people who are trained, specifically these special air service personnel. They're trained not to take prisoners. They're trained to torture people. They're trained to gather information, and they're trained to terrorize the local population. You don't have to go any further than, was it Abu Ghraib, when you see what happened in the prison with the torture, with prisoners that were naked, that were attacked by dogs. The dehumanization of other races and other religions and other nations is part and parcel of like Western imperialism. So, the brutality, there'd be nobody held to account. And these people will just basically get away with murder, and the victims and their families will never get any closure. And, let's not forget what's happening in Yemen. Let's not forget what's happening in Syria and in Libya. This is happening all over West Asia and further afield.
Sure.
And the brutality that we've witnessed in Ukraine as well from the fascists there, it's a mindset, and unfortunately, no one's held the account.
You mentioned a very key phrase there, Robert Frentina, and you said that this may be, or that this is, how orders have been handed from the top down, which is why it's executed by these special soldiers. And I found a sentence where it's interesting, where it said that it's the sort of violence that occurs in a war where brutality is encouraged from the top down. And then it went on to say Britain's whole occupation is built on it. Do you agree with that?
Yes, Britain has a long history as a colonial nation, over 100 years, and throughout its that colonial history, it's been very violent. Look at what the British did in India and other places. So violence is always part of war. It's always part of colonialism and occupation. We can look at what the Israelis are doing to the Palestinians and have been for decades now. Violent, oppressive, cruel, really inhumane. And these are the components of war and of occupation. They simply come with the territory, and they are all criminal. They're all crimes against humanity. They're all war crimes. But countries, governments continue to perpetrate them, or perpetuate them, I should say, and we don't see them being held to account in really any circumstances whatsoever.
This not being held to account is what the problem is, which I believe leads to, if you agree, Farah Hughes, to this being committed on a repeated case. When you take a look at what has been revealed, where the UK was aware for years about these SAS soldiers and they're basically committing war crimes, but criminal investigations were closed without any prosecutions to be brought forward, then that kind of is a green light for them to continue it in any other war scenario or any other scenario. It may not even involve a war scenario. Why would years of reports actually not be investigated, do you think?
Well, I think there's several parts to this, and one of them would be that the British government does not want the British people to know what's being done in their name by their army and by their special air services. And the other one is, we in the north of Ireland have gone through our own kind of post-conflict amnesty. The British government last year actually brought into, or is bringing onto the statute books, a law that would give amnesty to war crimes carried out by British personnel over the 30 years of the conflict here in the north of Ireland. And it's been suggested that the amnesty would be more wide-ranging than the amnesty that was offered by Pinochet to cover human rights violations in Chile when he was in charge. And Queen's University in Belfast and the Committee for the Administration of Justice have both said that this amnesty proposed by the British government on behalf of the British armed forces would go much further than another 300 post-conflict amnesties. So what we have is not only no accountability and British soldiers being above the law, but now the law is going to be changed in order to protect them from war crimes. And if I was in Afghanistan, I would actually be bringing cases before the ICC, the International Criminal Court, in The Hague, rather than try and get justice from the British government when none will be forthcoming.
Well, we have a situation here, Robert Frentina, where it's It's pretty interesting. You have the UK Ministry of Defense that created what was called the and I'm going to move to another war scenario, and it's called the other war that the UK was involved in, which was based on the false premise of supposed weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, which that never turned out to be the case. They actually created a ministry called the Iraq, not a ministry, but a team called the Iraq Historic Allegations Team, where it looked into accusations of abuse committed by the British in Iraq now between the years 2003 and 2006. And then they discovered some 280 victims of alleged unlawful killings and 1,235 cases of ill treatment, which included rape and torture. And then you have the government come up with a UK MP's committee, which said, you know what, that's not true, that can't be right. And they said it's an unstoppable, self-perpetuating machine, deaf to the concerns of the armed forces, and that it had to be shut down. How do you explain that?
This is only explained by the fact that the UK government, like many or most other governments, doesn't want to be constrained in any way by going to war wherever they choose to go. And as your other commentator mentioned, they want their people to think of the military and members of the military as noble and going around the world to help people. This, of course, is a huge lie and a complete myth. They don't want them to know the savagery that these soldiers commit on a regular basis. Now, the fact that the UK established a committee, identified war crimes, crimes against humanity, and then simply, with the stroke of a pen, voided those findings is beyond appalling. The innocent victims received no closure, there can be no compensation for loss of life. Nothing will compensate for that. But there's no accountability, and this just leaves the military, it gives the military free rein to commit whatever crimes it wants to in the future. So soldiers know from this that anything they do, they will not be held accountable for, and there's no limit to the cruelty they can inflict on their victims.
So let's take a look at some of the wars, and let's pick the two that really stands out, I think, for our Hughes, and the one in Afghanistan, obviously, and then, of course, the Iraq War. If you were to take a look at the way that the countries involved and their soldiers, how they acted in such a way, and I'm not talking about all of them, but obviously a portion of them that acted in the way that they did, where obviously violations of human rights was taking place at a minimum based on some of the grueling acts that have taken place, and I'm being very soft on calling it a violation of human rights. Didn't that contribute to the war itself to be lost and for there not to be a success, particularly, for example, when we take a look at Afghanistan, 20 years there, and you had UK soldiers, you had soldiers from ISAF, you had U.S. soldiers, but they didn't, as the one general once said, they wanted to win the hearts and minds, and they didn't. I believe it was the former General Flynn. It's because of these types of acts. Wasn't that a contributory to them not winning the war overall?
Yes, they used violent repression in order to stop resistance. So what they've done is they've invaded against the will of the Afghan and Iraqi people. The people have reacted and resisted this foreign military intervention and occupation. And in order to stop and try to prevent the resistance, then they bring about more repression, more fear, more murders, more torture, more violence. And the more that they use that, the more people react. If you kill someone in cold blood, who's innocent and unarmed, their brother, their friend, their son. It's not about revenge. People will just at some point say, this is not acceptable, and in order to stop this, we must make these foreign invaders leave our country. But the fact is that Britain and America and the other people involved in this, they tried hearts and minds here in Ireland as well. It's nothing more than propaganda, giving sweets to children, visiting people in hospital, trying to bring aid and succor and comfort to people in small communities. It's all PR. It's all propaganda. It's all a manipulation of the reality of what's happening on the ground. And you know, from the day and hour, any colonial power goes in and occupies any sovereign nation, there will always be resistance, and that resistance normally always wins. It's just a matter of time, be it 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, or in the case of Ireland, 800 years. But eventually, sure, people will fight and receive their freedom.
Indeed. Well, you have instances where, Robert Fintina, you have the accusations and then the proof that is out there, but yet the governments, the respective governments, don't want to follow through with the prosecution. In the case of the UK, since we've put some focus on that, even the ICC Court at The Hague has said hundreds of Iraqis, in terms of their testimonies, showed a pattern of beatings, sleep and sensory deprivation, stress positions, deprivation of food and water, sexual and religious humiliation, and what have you. Kind of sounds like a rap sheet for the American soldiers in Abu Ghraib and what they did there. So when this happens and so much time has gone by, doesn't this mean when the prosecutions are not there that there's a flaw in the system and that needs to be rectified? But then who do you go to do that? Because obviously these soldiers or whoever that's committing these war crimes are, they're immune to it. They're being shielded by the governments.
It's not a flaw in the system. The system is working the way the governments want it to work. They want to avoid and evade, push out the timeline investigation. Hopefully people forget. Hopefully the stories will and then they can sweep these atrocities under the rug and commit them again. Now, these new investigation that has launched or is in early next year will be probably another show, some testimony given, some witnesses, and then minor findings maybe determined or decided upon that there were some abuses here and there, but nothing that was typical. And then there might be one or two soldiers getting a slap on the wrist. But the people who are really responsible, the lead held accountable, and they will be free, commit these crimes against humanity again and again and again, simply because, as I said, this is the way for the governments. They want this free reign to do whatever they choose in whenever they're involved in a foreign invasion, and holding people accountable for their crimes against humanity would constrain them. It's as it should work, but it's not how the governments want it to work, so they have set up the system so that there will be no accountability.
Sure. Well, I can't help but look back, as our guest there was talking, Frahues, and get your thoughts on what was called the Chilcot Inquiry, where you had the case of this, as I mentioned before, in terms of the false notion of WMDs in Iraq, and yet you have the former UK Prime Minister Tony Blair or the former US President George Bush Jr. who have walked scot-free and they've been responsible for so many deaths. And still the remnants of that war are echoing in the hospital chambers of people who are suffering from nuclear remnants from ammunition that was used, that was tainted with nuclear material. I mean, it's just something not right about this.
Yes, you're probably referring to the massacre in Fallujah where they used depleted uranium. I mean, Tony Blair, in my mind, is a war criminal, and so is Bush. And all the deaths that occurred are all about foreign Western corporations going in and taking oil and gas and gold and whatever else it is that they took. And in Iraq, didn't they take millions, if not billions, of gold, pounds worth and dollars worth of gold bars that were in Iraq? And then on top of that, we can see through all this pain that still continues today. I mean, there's still landmines. There are still people losing their legs on a frequent basis in these countries from all the landmines that have been kind of abandoned all over the country in order to inflict further pain and torment kind of post-conflict after the war has been resolved. But there weren't only, you know, victims in Iraq and Afghanistan. You mentioned the Chilcot report, and it made me think straight away of David Kelly. David Kelly was the British scientist who was claimed to have sexed up the dossier in order to make it appear that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, which was the excuse used for the war. He walked off out into the woods near his home and didn't come back. They said he committed suicide. But in the film, The Killing of Kelly by George Galloway, there are persistent rumors that he was murdered. So the British government didn't just murder people in Iraq and Afghanistan. They quite possibly murdered a British scientist in order to cover up what he might have told any future inquiry as to how they came about with this whole notion of the weapons of mass destruction as an excuse to invade Iraq.
Sure. Looking down the road here, Robert Fantino, quickly, if you can answer this, are we looking at pretty much the status quo to continue based on the fact that you're not getting the prosecutions that these cases deserve for any future endeavors in a war scenario that in particular the U.S. may be involved with or the U.K., because usually they're, work with this special relationship they have hand in hand.
Yes, and most of the wars on the planet do involve the United States in one way or another. And yes, sadly, we are going to see a maintenance of the status quo. There will be some, as I mentioned before, some minor findings from this current investigation, as there were from U.S. investigations about abuses in Iraq. But then the next war will see the same kinds of crimes, same kinds of cover-ups, and the same kinds of pseudo-investigations. When you have the British government investigating its own soldiers, or the U.S. government investigating its own soldiers, that is not an impartial judge. There needs to be these things need to go to the ICC so that they can be viewed impartially. Otherwise, we're going to see the same continually.
Thank you for that. We appreciate it, Robert Fantino, author and journalist. Farah Hughes, thank you so much, journalist, author, and activist. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Yacoba Tahoe and the team, it's goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
Saudis are hiding many stories about the situation of human rights in their country. According to reports, there are hundreds of political prisoners languishing in the dungeons of the Saudi kingdom, which Mohammed bin Salman does not wish the world know about them. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Crescent International noted, while the Saudis are reveling in their team's freak victory over Argentina in Doha, Qatar, there is an even more important story that needs recounting. There are hundreds of political prisoners languishing in the dungeons of the medieval kingdom. The de facto ruler Mohammed bin Salman, known as MBS, may not wish the world know about them, but they must not be forgotten. Just as the Saudis were celebrating their victory on November 22nd and not likely to be repeated, the date coincided with completion of the 10-year sentence of human rights activist Professor Mohammad Fahad Al-Qahtani. Yet, he has not been released. Instead, he has been moved to another prison, but his whereabouts are not known even to his family. Dr. Mohammad Al-Qahtani's prison term has expired and he has not been released. Adel Al-Said, an activist with the European Saudi Organization for Human Rights, was quoted by Middle East Eye as saying, Al-Qahtani is a professor of economics and a political activist. His sin was that he was one of the founding members of the Saudi Civil and Political Rights Association, ACPRA. The organization has since been disbanded. Professor Al-Qahtani and co-founder of the organization, Abdullah Al-Hamid, were arrested in 2010. They were handed 10 and 11-year prison sentences, respectively. What was their crime? They were accused of breaking allegiance to the ruler, questioning the integrity of officials, seeking to disrupt security and inciting disorder, and instigating international organizations against the kingdom. These allegations are bizarre. Is allegiance to the ruler compulsory? As for the integrity of officials, one only need recall the brutal murder of Jamal Khashoggi in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul in October 2018. Saudi officials, on orders from MBS, not only murdered Khashoggi in cold blood, but also chopped his body. It is widely believed that the body was then dissolved in acid. It has never been recovered. Al-Qahtani's family was naturally looking forward to his release after he completed his sentence. His wife, however, altered human rights activists more than 20 days ago that the prison administration had prevented him from communicating and transferred him to another unknown location. In prison, Al-Qahtani was being harassed by other inmates. When he submitted a complaint to the prison authorities, Al-Qahtani was transferred to an unknown location, according to ESOHR. His fellow co-founder of ACPRA, Abdullah Al-Hamid, died in prison in 2020. He had suffered a stroke 2 weeks earlier, but was kept in detention despite being in a coma at the hospital. Several other founding members of ACRPA are also behind bars, including human rights lawyer Walid Abu Al-Khair and Muhammad Al-Bajadi. The latter was detained without charge or trial in 2018 and remains behind bars. Adel Al-Said of ECOHR said that Saudi Arabia was not releasing political prisoners even after they had served their prison term. These include Muhammad al-Rabaya, Isa al-Nokefi, two other activists who served their terms but have not been released, according to Said. While the Saudi regime has always been brutal towards those demanding basic rights, the campaign of oppression has intensified since the ascent of MBS to power. Scores of academics, human rights activists, lawyers, preachers, economists and women's rights activists have been arrested and languish in prison. There is no codified law in Saudi Arabia. The whim of the presiding judge passes for law. Judges are notorious for pandering to MBS wishes. They know that any person who has been arrested has clearly run afoul of the Crown Prince. They are sentenced to harsh prison terms. Even lawyers defending clients have been sentenced to prison for the temerity of defending the accused. Such well-known figures as Salman al-Awda, Ali al-Omari, and Awad al-Gharni are facing execution. They did not kill anyone. They simply called for peace between fellow Muslims. The case of Sheikh Salman al-Awda is instructive. In September 2017, Sheikh Salman al-Awda had prayed for reconciliation between Saudi Arabia and Qatar. This was soon after MBS cut off relations with its smaller neighbor and imposed harsh sanctions on it. In January 2021, MBS made up with Qatar and invited the emir, Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad al-Thani, to Saudi Arabia. Relations have been fully restored. MBS even attended the opening ceremony of FIFA World Cup on November 20th and was warmly received by Sheikh Hamad. So, why is Sheikh Salman is still in prison and facing the death sentence? This is what Saudi Arabia, a society ruled by savages, is all about. According to Press TV, hawkish Republican Senator Tom Cotton has agreed with the Biden administration's decision to grant sovereign immunity to Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman over journalist Jamal Khashoggi's 2018 murder. What the administration has touted this week is granting sovereign immunity to Mohammed bin Salman is in keeping with the practice of custom of lawsuits involving foreign heads of state, Cotton told Fox News recently, adding, "It would have been a major break if those customs did not grant that kind of immunity." The U.S. State Department recently gave bin Salman immunity from the lawsuit despite Joe Biden's earlier promise to hold the de facto Saudi ruler accountable for the crime. Citing its constitutional authority as well as customary international law, the State Department said Prime Minister bin Salman, as a sitting head of government, is immune, while in office from the jurisdiction of the United States District Court is in this suit. Amnesty International recently condemned the Biden administration and called the act a deep betrayal. Amnesty Secretary General Agnes Callamard said in a statement, "The U.S. government should hang its head in shame. This is nothing more than a sickening, total, deep betrayal. First, the evidence of the Crown Prince's involvement in Jamal Khashoggi's murder was disregarded by President Trump, then President Biden's first bump. It all suggests shady deals made throughout." The U.S. intelligence community previously concluded the killing of Khashoggi, a Saudi dissident, was ordered by the Crown Prince. But Cotton claimed other regimes had done worse and that Washington could not be too fastidious with its foreign partners. Cotton said on Fox News, "Saudi Arabia is far from the world's worst abuser of human rights. Look, if it didn't have allies and partners who don't always share our political systems or our cultural and social sensibilities, we wouldn't have any allies and partners," he said. Khashoggi, who was murdered and dismembered by a Saudi hit squad at the kingdom's consulate in Istanbul on October 2, 2018, used to be a vocal critic of the Saudi regime and the Crown Prince. According to reports, he was lured into the diplomatic mission under the pretext of being provided with papers for his wedding. He was suffocated and dismembered while his fiancée waited outside for him. Biden vowed during his presidential campaign to make Saudi Arabia a pariah following Khashoggi's killing, but he reversed course in July as he traveled to the country and gave a fist bump to bin Salman. Fred Ryan, the publisher of the Washington Post, has blasted Biden for both the trip and the recent move to grant the Crown Prince immunity. Ryan wrote of Biden, "He is granting a license to kill to one of the world's most egregious human rights abusers." Cotton said that federal laws have changed to allow U.S. citizens to sue governments that sponsor terrorist attacks, but he pointed out those changes don't apply to the Khashoggi case. "When you're talking about individuals who are at the head of a foreign government, it's been customary for decades to grant them immunity," Cotton said. "So it would be a major break and another effort in the campaign to alienate and ostracize Saudi Arabia not to recognize this traditional kind of immunity," Cotton claimed. Later in the program, Senate Intelligence Committee Chair Mark Warner said he agreed with Cotton's claim, saying the reason why there was a grant of sovereign immunity even to leaders we don't like is as much to protect American leaders and American diplomats when they're posted abroad from being subject to Saudi Arabian law or South African law, Warner told Bream, adding, "So this has been historical precedent." Saudi Arabia initially issued conflicting stories about Khashoggi's disappearance, but eventually said he had been killed in a rogue operation. Despite denials by Riyadh's regime, some Western governments and spy agencies said the Crown Prince had ordered the assassination, causing a global uproar.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.